To speak about Buddhism and environmentalism is overwhelming, actually. As I've been thinking about this for a while, and it's almost like, you know, in the stories about the Buddha's enlightenment, he meets Mara just before he gets enlightened. Somehow I feel like with this particular topic, it's sort of Mara, like Mara is out there, you know. Because Mara is like the personification of everything that's confused, greedy, and fearful that human beings face. And when I think about the environmental problems that are developing in the world, I think about everything that is this huge manifestation of the results of ignorance, out of balance desire and fears that, you know, that's created this incredible situation that we're all looking at, and sometimes we spend an awful lot of time ignoring because of how appalling the reality is when we actually look at it. I don't mean to be depressing in saying all of this, but it's the truth of the matter. And so the question is, what is it? I mean, the scientists are telling us a lot about what's going on in the world that's problematic. And some of the economists around are doing the same thing, you know, the ones that are a little bit more mindful and open-hearted about things rather than the economists who are pawns of the powers that are creating all these problems. And sometimes I'll say things like that, powers, because I feel like there are things at work which are so huge that it's almost hard to talk about them in any other way except as great forces at work at the world, in the world. And in fact, maybe that's what's happening. One of the things that I'll be wanting to do is look at some of the ancestors, if you will, of this way of thinking about the environmental situation we're facing, the Buddhist ancestors, like Alan Watts, who's deceased. So they were ancestor, or elders who are still with us but have been drawing attention to problems. I mean, Watts, I found an audio recording of Watts talking about environmentalism back in the mid-60s, and he has a very interesting way of talking about it because it's from the mid-60s, and it's Alan Watts, and so he has his own ways of talking about things, of course. But elders like Stephanie Kaza, Joanna Macy, poets like Gary Snyder, these are some of the folks that I want to talk about. Then, of course, naturally, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And there's some interesting things to talk about there and to point our attention to there before we actually all get together with him, those of us that are getting together with him anyway. So there's a lot, and I've been thinking really deeply about this. And I've been thinking really deeply about the elders, and I've been thinking about our situation as who we are, and also then thinking about our obligations to the future, because in the future we'll be the elders, and in the farther future we'll be the ancestors. Because that's just the way stuff is when you think about what Joanna Macy calls even the superficial level of deep time. You're looking very far in the future and into the past and thinking about your obligations. Macy is so rash that she's had ideas like turning watchfulness about nuclear waste almost into a religion, because the stuff's going to be around for so long. If human beings don't pay attention to it, it's just going to come back and get them. So how to deal with something like that? She's a very profound thinker. In many cases, Kayla and I have been fortunate to meet, study with, or know some of these people. And we respect them very deeply for that. I never had the opportunity to meet up with Alan Watts or, say, Gregory Bateson, somebody else that I respect very deeply. But they've all influenced me. In fact, Watts was the first person I read when I started studying Buddhism. I started studying Zen back in the mid-early 60s, actually, come to think of it. Because it was Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki, and Alan Watts was pretty much, if you're interested in Buddhism, that's pretty much who you're going to be reading back then, you know? And Lord, how things have changed that now there's so many people that we can be paying attention to and that are contributing to thoughtfulness about so many different things. Anyway, I want to start with Stephanie Kaza. And one of the reasons I wanted to start with Stephanie is because she's so basic and she's so grounded and she's so human in everything that she does. And she's a Buddhist, but she's also an environmental scientist. So she's one of those rare people that has very sophisticated feet in both worlds. Spent a lot of time, well, maybe considering the span of her life, not a lot of time, but she spent some time at Green Gulch Zen Center, where Kay got to know her, and I met her briefly, which is where we practiced, practiced Zen. So Kaza has a book out that that I'll be referencing called Mindfully Green, A Personal and Spiritual Guide to Whole Earth Thinking. And this is sort of based upon her work at the University of Vermont, where she's been teaching for a very long time now. And it has the sophistication that comes from mindfully teaching undergraduates for a lifetime. Something that is difficult, but something that's designed to change them. Now, maybe better to say something that's designed to facilitate them changing themselves. And that would be more the truth of the thing, I believe. There are quite a number of chapters in here. And if one were to read this, one would also see the influence of Thich Nhat Hanh in this and a number of other people. The first three chapters, though, I want to speak to, at least in an overview. The first one is called Reducing Harm. The second one is called Being with the Suffering. The third one is called Embracing the Deep View. And they're all part one, Seeking Green Principles. When I read through these three chapters, what struck me was that Stephanie had taken, either consciously, intentionally, or intuitively, I don't know which it would be, she'd taken something that has been a very important framework for my own teaching, which is the three principal aspects of the path, which goes back to Tsongkhapa in Tibet, late 13th century, early 14th century, who was asked by one of his students to do something that is actually kind of traditional in Buddhism, which is from the time of the Buddha, the scriptures grew and became more and more complex and different schools of thought developed. And then poor students like us would say, this is too complicated. Isn't there some sort of summary? We would call it, isn't there something like Buddhism for dummies, right? So even 500 years ago, somebody was asking Tsongkhapa, who was an enlightened teacher, no doubt about it, isn't there something like Buddhism for dummies? So he wrote a 14-stanza poem, which he sent to his disciple, who was in the northeastern part of Tibet, when Tsongkhapa was in south central Tibet. And it was called The Three Principal Aspects of the Path. And it's the three key elements that one needs to understand if one is going to practice successfully as a Buddhist, at least from the Tibetan point of view. And my attention came to this because when I asked one of my main teachers, what should I be teaching? And now this is in the 1980s, Tara Tulku, he said, You can always teach people the three principal aspects of the path. It's foundational, it's important. Well, what I realized was the three principal aspects of the path, the first principal aspect of the path is called usually renunciation, and I'll explain what that means. The second aspect is called compassion, and the third is called wisdom. And I realized those lined up with what Stephanie was teaching. So renunciation lines up with reducing harm, altruism lines up with being with the suffering, and wisdom lines up with embracing the deep view. Let me start with the first one, with renunciation, because for Americans in particular, that word is really problematic. And it is the right word for translating what the Buddhists are talking about, but there's an art to translation. And sometimes the exact right word isn't the exact right word. You know, the exact English for a Tibetan or Sanskrit word is the exact word, but because of the connotations, it's not the exact word. It doesn't really get at it. And I think it was Geshe Sonam Rinchen teaching three principal aspects of the path. It might have been somebody else. And their translator translated renunciation as giving up on the world, not giving up the world, which would be renunciation in the conservative sense of renunciation, but giving up on the world in the sense of the world is not going to provide you by itself what you are wanting. Okay? It's sort of like we're all looking for happiness, the Dalai Lama says. We're all looking for happiness. It's his way of saying the traditional Buddhist principle of suffering. But again, Americans don't like to hear about suffering. They like to hear about we want to be happy. It's just the flip side of the same coin. So he says, we're all looking for happiness, but we somehow just don't know how to get real happiness. It doesn't seem to work out. And one of the reasons for that is that in regards to the material world, the objective world, where we think we're going to find happiness, two things come together. It's what we bring to the experience and what's out there. And as Americans, the way we are programmed in our culture is that you just go get what's out there, it's going to elicit the internal happiness. And we've all been around long enough to know that that only works within limits, but ultimately it doesn't work. You know, when I get the new electronic toy or the new nifty shirt or whatever shows up in the Christmas package, it's cool for a little while, but that doesn't last very long. But if I have a deep sense of gratitude towards what's happening, or if I bring some other qualities that are internal to that experience, that objective experience of that thing, then it becomes very different. So it's not so much that renunciation means renouncing the world in some sort of ascetic Christian sense, which is, I think, that's the baggage we all bring to that word. You know, we think of the Middle Ages, hair shirts, you know, cold monasteries, eating hard bread and that kind of thing. That's not what the Buddhists mean by renunciation. What they mean is much more along the lines of giving up on the idea that satisfaction is going to come from the world alone, with an understanding that there's a relationship between one's internal state and what's going on in the world, and that's where the happiness and satisfaction are going to come from. That relationship and that cultivating the internal is critical to really finding that happiness. So what Kaza does when she talks about reducing harm is she really takes that another step and says, what's really going on in our relationship with the external world? Because the thing about the way we're programmed, so now this is the thumbnail, and she goes into this, not so much in analytic detail, but in almost Socratic self-questioning and observing and self-reflecting detail. What's going on is, the way we in this culture are programmed is to think more and more stuff is going to make us happier. And what that does is it generates the harm that's going on all around us. You know, why is it that things are the way they are? We are harming the world by the way we live in the world. And so she reflects on how to reduce harm. And reducing harm, in the sense of Tsongkhapa, is connected with giving up on the world in the sense of more of it is not going to make us happy. Which is not to say we don't need some of it, and that's the
middle way.
Well, it is the middle way, but what I was reaching for is that's the conundrum. The conundrum is we can't stop being in the world and living in the world in ways which are problematic. That's the conundrum. But as she says, we can reduce the problem even if we can't make it go away completely. And she talks a lot about what can we do to understand what's happening, free ourselves from the programming in that process, and harm less. Okay. Ultimately, we can't stop harming. You know, can we be vegetarians or not? Some of us perhaps can be, and some of us can't be because our health won't sustain it. Even the Dalai Lama, who tried very, very with deep, pure motivation to be a vegetarian, discovered that his body would not permit him to be a vegetarian because he wouldn't be healthy. And he was almost destroying his health by trying to be a vegetarian. So he eats as little meat as possible, and he recommends doing things like, well, if you have to have some meat, only have meat every other day, or think about where it comes from, so on and so forth. And it leads to some surprising things when you really reflect deeply on what that's about. But so he's really promoting the idea of reducing the amount of harm, because it's not ultimately possible given the way we are human beings in this big eating machine, which is our planet, to stop eating entirely. Because we happen to live in a world where everything eats everything for the most part. Everything's eating something. Now, you know, some critters can get away with eating grass. Human beings don't happen to be critters like that. We're not built to be able to do that. So that creates problems, and harming will, in a sense, be inevitable, but can we reduce it? We have to stay warm. If you live in the Grand, you know you have to stay warm. How are you going to do that? There's no alternative but what? Wood? Natural gas? I mean, solar? I mean, but even no matter what you do, ultimately, you're going to impact the world. So there are conundrums that are associated with that. So Kaza leads us into thinking about those things, and so it's worth doing. And I'm not going to pursue that in great detail. That's not my purpose here. But you just make that linkage between a traditional view of things, which is giving up on the world, the first principal aspect of the path, and reducing harm, which is a very archaic Buddhist principle. In the very beginning, the Buddha says this, that one needs to reduce the harm that one's doing. Or as the Buddhists these days say, you know, take care of people. If you can't take care of people, at least don't hurt them. And reducing harm. You know. Now, reducing harm is not all that easy for other reasons, because sometimes we don't even know how we're harming. We don't really even know what's going on. And there are a lot of reasons for that. The second chapter in her book, Being with Suffering, is really about the compassionate view of relationship, in which one recognizes that there's a problem, like we live in this big eating machine, or it's impossible to get by without cutting trees or, you know, using natural gas or heating oil or something. And we know that that's creating problems. And how do we deal with that? And so what she's saying is, with a compassionate attitude, you just sit with it. Like when people are dying, there's a way in which there's not a whole lot you can do about the fact that they're dying, but you can sit with them with an open heart, and that makes a difference. to them and to you too, by the way, because you start seeing stuff and learning stuff and understanding stuff, which you can't see, learn, and understand unless you're there with an open heart. If you're there with fear and a closed heart, you don't learn anything, really, I think. I've not been around a lot of dying people, two parents. But when I was open, I learned stuff, and when I wasn't, I didn't. And when I was open, it helped them, and when I wasn't, it didn't help them. You know, so that much I did learn anyway. So the practice of compassion, which is founded on a certain notion of relationship, of deep intimacy and interbeing, as Macy would say, deep connectedness. You know, that practice of compassion is, on the one hand, hoping for the best and wanting to do the best for all beings, or the being sitting next to you or lying in the bed that you're, you know, there if they're dying. That kind of being is what I mean, or being with is what I mean. And if we have compassion, that in itself helps. But also, if we have compassion, that allows us to see deeply why it is that we give up on the world, because we see also that it's what we as human beings bring to the experience that in many cases is much more important in terms of generating happiness and reducing harm than what's actually there and given. The objective reality of things is not objective. It changes in accordance with our relationship with it. Objective reality, that's some kind of 19th century mechanistic fantasy that comes out of the Enlightenment, that there is such a thing. There is no such thing as objective reality. Even the physicists will tell us that. They know that very distinctly. There is some sort of negotiation that goes on between the inside and the outside, and that's where reality is. So if we approach that with compassion, what comes out of that negotiated coming togetherness, is a different kind of reality, at some level anyway. And finally, she talks about embracing the deep view, which is the real direct view of the wisdom of how everything connects with everything, and how ultimately everything is created out of our own relationship and our own views and our own understanding. And out of that, we start seeing, because we can see, because we've been compassionate and we've been practicing non-harming, we can see how everything deeply interconnects and how things interbe, to use Thich Nhat Hanh's language and the language that Macy uses, how everything deeply interconnects, not just in relationship, but existentially, how we interbe, how it is that the food that I consume in this huge eating machine becomes this body and generates the energy, which is this mind, and which is this understanding, and turns into these words. So what you're hearing here, right, is fully dependent upon all these other beings that have aggregated in my body and in my speech and in my mind in so many different ways to be here, you know, in this conversation. Well, in this talk, in this conversation later, but in this talk, it's all right here. But we don't see that moment by moment. It's too much to see moment by moment. We maybe see it when we're meditating or if we stop to think about it, but on a moment by moment basis, as we're going about our affairs, washing the dishes, driving to work, talking to the student with the problem, or the person that's ill, or the checker in the grocery store, my favorite example for how to practice compassion is the checkers at the counter, the checkout counter in Safeway, you know, who see hundreds and hundreds of people go past them every day, and everybody treats each other like there's some sort of transaction going on, you know, and they are required to have a certain script, you know. And they're a great opportunity for the practice of compassion. I don't want to objectify them. They're people, and that's the whole point. You can actually break into the script and try and talk with them, and they appreciate it, but then they have to get back on script, of course, because they're required to. But they appreciate being treated like a human being and not be objectified as like just an extension of the cash register or whatever the heck it is, you know. So we, you know, we can have this deep view, and things come out of this deep view. And Macy in particular will share some of the things that come out of this deep view when we get to that particular point. So, three principal aspects of the path: non-harming, being compassionate, and being with compassion, and the deep view. They all interconnect. And Macy talks about deep time, and this is an interesting example of deep time, how something in a poem written in Tibet in 1400, because I don't know exactly when it was written, but that's good enough. It's within 10 or 20 years of when it was written, resonates into something that Stephanie Kaz is writing in the United States in 2000 and whatever, you know. And will resonate with something that's in the future, because, you know, the people of the future will be looking at things that require all of this stuff. I mean, we'll need it too, but they'll need it, you know. And so in some way we pass this on to them in the view of deep time. I'll talk more about that when it comes to talking about Macy.
So I wanted to bring up, you're lucky we're here.